The next phase of the journey lasted for several days. It couldn't have been more different from those first 24 hours. We no longer had that high bandwidth link to the ground. Between that and the fact that we didn't have much to do, things got quiet. The burn that had taken us out from the shelter of the balloon had put us in a predicament, vis-a-vis the Dabinernud, a little like that of a bird that is on a collision course with an aerocraft. We would definitely reach the Dabinernud now, but if we didn't want to end up as a spray of freeze-dried flesh on its rubbly surface, we would need to slow down before we smacked into it. Any other space mission would have done it with a brief rocket engine burn at the last minute, followed by some nice work with maneuvering thrusters. But since we were trying to sneak up, that wouldn't work. We needed a way of generating thrust that didn't involve a sudden brilliant ejaculation of white-hot gases. The Convox had found the answer in the form of an electrodynamic tether, which was nothing more than a string with a weight on the end, with electricity running through it in one direction. The string was about 5 miles long. It was slender but strong, similar to our cords. In order to keep it taut, we had to dangle a weight from the end. The weight turned out to be our spent and now useless Magnifix, concealed under a smaller and simpler version of the coal-black mirror. So our first task, once we had broken out from the shelter of the balloon, was to lash the Magnifix together into a compact mass, to deploy another mirror above them, and to attach them to the end of the tether. We waited until Arb was between us and the Dabinernud before commencing the most ticklish, verging on insane, part of the operation, which was to throw ourselves into a spin and then use the resulting centrifugal force to pay out the 5 miles of line. This was sickening and terrifying for a few minutes, until we and the counterweight got a little farther apart. This slowed the rate at which we and the counterweight spun around our common center of gravity so that Arb was no longer whipping past us quite so frequently. By the time the counterweight was at the end of the string, the rotation had slowed to the point where we barely noticed it. From now on, we would spin exactly once during each orbit, which simply meant that the counterweight was always 5 miles below us, the string was oriented vertically, and the coal-black mirror was always above us, where we wanted it. This slow rotation yielded pseudogravity at a level of about 1/100 of what we felt on the surface of Arb, so we and all of our stuff slowly fell upwards, away from the planet, unless something stopped us. The something was the frame of inflated tube struts that helped keep the coal-black mirror stretched out flat. We drifted up against it and remained caught there like litter pressed against a fence by an imperceptible breeze. Shortly after completing this maneuver, we passed onto the night side of Arb. This afforded us an excellent view when the pedestal rotted all of the big orbital launch facilities around Arb's equator. The planet was mostly black, with skeins and clots of light sprawling across the temperate parts of the landmasses where people tended to live. The incoming rods drew brilliant streaks across this backdrop, as if thonic gods trapped beneath Arb's crust were slicing their way to freedom with cutting torches. When a rod hit the ground, its light was snuffed out for a moment, then reborn as a hemispherical bloom of warmer, redder light, comparable to a nuclear explosion, but without the radioactivity. We orbited over the very launch pad from which Jezri had begun his first journey into space and got a perfect view of an orange fist reaching up toward us. Jezri was fussing over the tender at the time, but he paused in his labors for a few minutes to watch as we flew over. I heard a little mechanical pop and looked over to see that Arcibald had just jacked a hardwire into the front of my suit. This was how we'd be talking to each other from now on. Even the short-range wireless was considered too much of a risk. Instead, we physically connected ourselves suit to suit with wires. Likewise, we no longer had the 24/7 high bandwidth link to the ground. Instead, Saman was bringing up some kind of link that squirted information, slowly and sporadically, along a narrow line of sight beam that the geometers would not be able to detect. So if Cell 87 had anything to say to me after this, they'd say it in the form of text messages that would flash up on the virtual screen inside my face mask, but not immediately. We had been told to expect delays on the order of 2 hours. And if we didn't hardwire ourselves into the reticule, we'd not be able to send or receive anything.
"It is a high wire act," Arcibald remarked.
Out of habit, I looked at his face mask, but saw nothing except for the distorted reflection of a mushroom cloud. So I looked down at the screen mounted to his chest and saw his face, staring down at Arb, then glancing up to make eye contact of a sort. I collected myself for a moment. This was the first real conversation I'd had in days. Since I'd choked down the big pill and climbed into the suit, every sound I'd made, every beat of my heart, every swallow of water I had taken, had been recorded and transmitted somewhere in real time. I'd gotten into the habit of assuming that every word I spoke was being monitored by pension rooms, discussed in committees, and archived for eternity. Hardly a way to have an honest or an interesting conversation. But I'd very quickly adjusted to not having Cell 87's voice in my ears. And now Arcibald and I had the opportunity to talk. No one else was hardwired to us. We were alone together, as if strolling through the page trees at Edhar,